So today we're doing a new episode of the Human Centered AI podcast. And with us, we have our colleague, Jonas Ivarsson. Welcome, Jonas.
Thank you.
So, Jonas, you're researching AI. You have a background in cognitive science, in pedagogy, and now in informatics. So you have quite an interesting perspective on things. And today we are going to want you to explain to us what human-centered AI is. But first, would you like to give our listeners a short introduction of yourself?
All right, yeah. So as you said, I have a background in cognitive science as my undergraduate degree. And when I was doing that, I was obviously looking into AI and computer science, psychology. But I became interested in sort of education as a application field for these questions. So how do we become the humans that we are? So I pursued a PhD in education. During that time, I was looking at representations, technologies, and how they shape learning processes. And that, I would say, also was the time when I had some kind of focus on school and schooling and education. So after my PhD, I shifted over to adults and knowledge processes, how different practitioners work with technologies to develop their skills, to redevelop their skills when new technologies come in and so on. And this sort of development itself led me onto the track of more advanced technologies. And eventually I saw that the sort of resurgence of AI would be the kind of dominant field where technologies have a large impact on how people work and how they learn their respective fields and so on. So that led me also to change tack a bit and change department and change my direction. So after having been a professor of education, I shifted over and now I'm working in informatics.
So do you shift to the technology of AI? What were the technologies that you were looking at before?
Before, I was looking very much at different kinds of representational technologies. For instance, I was working with architects and designers on their use of digital technologies for doing their work, for working with design work, representational work. I was also working with other kinds of visual technologies in the field of medicine. So I've been collaborating with dentists and with radiologists for many years. We've also been working with surgeons who work with visualization technologies. So those types where you have visual representations of internal parts of the body, for instance, as a sort of core part of the practice of radiology. That was an interest of mine. And these practices have experienced changes. They experienced technology developments. And that sort of put pressure on the practitioners to also sort of follow along and change what they do. But of course, these practices now saw that, okay, AI is also going to be a part of this technology in itself. So it wasn't just a new algorithm for how you represent something, but it became more active, more adaptive, and so on. So, yeah.
What was it that made you realize that AI was probably going to be the thing that you wanted to look more at, or that you thought was going to be a focus?
Yeah, I'd been interested in AI before, but my education was done in mid-90s, so we did some different tests with AI and built neural networks and so on. But of course, at that time, the technology wasn't as mature. So I wasn't so interested in developing the tech itself. So I wanted to work with other things. But around 2016, perhaps, I was observing the developments in the field and saw that now this is becoming much more interesting. Now there are applications out there. The processing power has been increasing. The data is now available. So I could see sort of that there was a change coming. I wasn't sure, but I became interested and thought that this is probably going to be bigger than it is right at that moment. So then I went back to learning the stuff again, or again, I would say more than I had before. So looking at the math, looking at the basics, and really, to know the field from the ground up in a more thorough sense. And I would say it's been that kind of idea that this will grow and become more important, correct judgment at that time.
Was there a lot of new stuff you had to learn from what you learned in the 90s then starting again in
2016? Oh yeah, yeah, all of it, I would say. We didn't go so deep into the mathematics and the algebra and so on. We played around with some. I mean, we tested both symbolic AI and some of what was then called connectionist models, and which are now known as neural networks. But what we did at that time was very basic.
So given that this is the human-centered AI pod, and given your wide experience in many different fields and your experience in AI, this notion of human centricity in AI, would you say that that's something that is relatively new, or did you see these things going on already back in the 90s?
Yeah, it wasn't expressed in that way. I mean, depends on how you look at it. There was one part of AI, the development of AI, that was inspired by how humans work. So in that sense, it was like very clearly a focus on what are the things that make humans work the way they do. And so the inspiration from the human brain, for instance, in developing systems and so on. So modeling AI systems based on the idea of how a human functions. That could be seen as a sense of, like, it's not, I would say, what we think of today as a human-centric, but it's like there was clearly a connection between the human side and the technological side. Then I think that maybe went away for a while, and what we have today is something different. It's an understanding that, yes, we can't just develop technology and let it run, but we have to take into consideration the impacts and sort of the interactions with humans. So I think that is something else.
Okay. So I'm going to come back to the question I ask to all of our guests, and that's, so human centricity, human-centered AI on the one side, and fairness, accountability, transparency, ethics, and so on the other. And for me, these things are super connected, but they're also a bit different, although they also address the same topics. How do you see the relation between the, you know, fact, faith, whatever, and human-centered AI?
I mean, one of the aspects there with that faith perspective is, of course, the ethical. It's tied into human values, and human values that we see as important today. So I would say it's a kind of a value-laden approach. I would say that there are also other aspects to this equation which are not necessarily connected to values in that sense, that there are parts of a relationship that AI can have to humans that are, it will have effects, but it comes from not a more pure research, but from a perhaps from a different conceptual direction. So my take on, I mean, I know you like to ask these questions, what is human-centered? And I'm always a bit sort of uncomfortable in answering questions of what something is. But I understand it's a reasonable question to ask. And the reason is that it sort of can build this idea that there is something to be found if you just look closely enough, that there is something there. And I think it's more that we can have different perspectives, we can have different ideas and different interests in something that we now call human-centered AI. So the question for me is, what is it that makes this area interesting? What do I find fascinating with these topics? So I like to answer it from that perspective. For me, it starts before you take in AI. It starts with a human and what a human is, what it is to be human today in a society like the one we have. Because we are first and foremost very, like, yes, we are embodied creatures, but we are also social beings. So we grow up in this social environment. And a big part of that is that we have a language. We share certain notions, and this is, we build a sense of understanding between each other through these notions and through this language. So that's a super important part. Then we also have this aspect of, we also use a lot of technology. Technology is a parcel of our social world. we have clothes, we have houses, we use tools to do a lot of things. And that's also a fundamental part of who we are and who we become, that we take on these tools and we can do other things. They extend our agency in certain directions and they restrict our abilities in other ways. So there is a shaping of us as humans through these technologies. And for me, that's super fundamental to understand and to have that, take that into consideration. And for a very long time, these technologies, they have been there, and they're central, but they have been more or less stable, in not that stable over generations, but once you put it in place, they have stayed the same. A hammer has stayed the same throughout. You're using it as a hammer. You have to develop your language, your writing, with the words that are being like put in circulation. And that this is something where I think that the AI of today and tomorrow is going to change things, because it is now introducing a type of change and a type of creativity that we have never seen from technology. We have seen it from other humans, and we know it from other humans, that we can interact in a certain way with other individuals, that they react and they are unpredictable and so forth. And this is happening now with technology and with AI. So that for me, that's the interesting part of this human centeredness, to understand these points of departure and then look at, okay, what's happening now in this field? How is this going to have an effect? And what are the reactions going to be?
So would that be sort of a sign of maturity of AI as a tool that humanity uses?
Yes, maybe maturity, or it's a new sort of another step in this, I don't know, change of how things operate. I think it's a major shift in what it can mean. And the reason for this is that we have built certain mechanisms in our social interactions with others, that we, of course, we interact over sequences, like back and forth between each other, but that kind of interactive patterns that are built there, those are now being mimicked by technology, and they put themselves in the place of what used to be a human position when they respond and so on. And I think that's going to have short-term consequences, that people are going to be deceived and don't understand what this is. People are going to misinterpret the abilities and the intentions and so on of technology, because they have only seen this kind of actions coming from other humans, where you normally attribute a lot of things. So that attribution of capabilities is going to follow along with when the technology takes these positions. In the long run, I think we will learn how to adapt to that situation, and that we will have a better understanding of the differences between what can these machines actually do, and what are just sort of a pretense versus what can I expect of a human and so on. But right now, this is a blurry boundary, and we are not trained, I would say, to see the differences. So for me, that's coming back to human-centered AI. I would like to explore this kind of developing sense of what it is to interact with artificial intelligence.
You say that we will learn to live with this. Are you sure about that? And when will that happen?
I mean, sure is maybe a strong word. I hope we will learn to deal with this, and I hope that the developers of the technology will take, because then that comes back to the ethical side of this. I mean, there are choices to be made here. You can develop systems that are not hiding certain aspects from you. It might be clearer what they are capable of doing and so on. If that is done in this way, I think we can learn to navigate this kind of landscape. But there could also be another development where these technologies always mask what they are, how they operate, and what they can do. If that development becomes the norm, then I think we're going to have problems. So in that sense, this fact side of fate and so on, it has an important role to play in pointing out all of these choices and, in a sense, the moral obligations of the developers to be careful about what they put on the market.
So a couple of follow-up questions. The first one, just to understand a little bit better, because when you say that, you see that the difference between AI technology and a hammer is sort of the hammer is kind of a static thing. That was kind of, you make a hammer and now it's a hammer and it stays a hammer. And whereas with this stuff, it seems to be changing. But I guess it depends on the time scale, because you could say the same thing for almost any digital technology, at least for the last 20 years, that, you know, we have, we didn't always have social networks, and social networks today are not what social networks were in the beginning of the 2000s and stuff like that. But you're not talking about even within generational change, but within interaction change. Is that what you mean as a difference?
I mean, a core difference here is whether or not the technology is trying to predict your next move or predict sort of something larger that you don't have a grasp of. So yes, the social networks and so on, they, I would say they operate on a different level. Like, how can you understand the YouTube algorithm? And people are struggling with this. They can't really make sense of how should I act so that it acts in a certain way? Or how can I know what it's going to do with my contribution? So this kind of action or agency on behalf of a technological system that is completely blocked, where we have no insight and no understanding of it. I think that's one recent development. And I see it more coming also in closer interactions with AI. So the way that we work with other people is that we have sometimes called these interaction pairs. We have interact through, I first say something, I do something, and I get a response. And what I do is sometimes called the first pair part. So if I greet you, I make a greeting. As a second pair part, it's often expected to have a greeting back. So that greeting back is a response to my first greeting. If it's not delivered, then action in itself becomes accountable. I see, so, oh, you're not greeting me back. Or maybe you're angry with me, or maybe you didn't hear me. But it's sort of, it's built up through these back and forth. But it's also that, and if I have something else, if maybe I have a question, I expect an answer, for instance. In these types of interactions, we check our own common understanding. And for a very long time, we had interactions with technology through chatbots and interfaces and so on. And what they did was they built on this paired interaction. Like, I did something, I got a response back. If it was wrong, I have to do something again, something new, and I got a new response. But that second sort of interaction had no memory of the prior one. So you always started anew. What's happening now is that you're building that kind of memory into the interaction, so you can actually do what we call repairs in interaction. I can say that, no, you misunderstood me, I meant this, and point back to what was said earlier, and we sort of correct that misunderstanding and move on. This type of interaction is now possible through the large language models, but we are not really accustomed to work with technology in this way. And what happens, or what can happen, I think, is that you also overinterpret the capabilities, even the sentience of these systems, because now they are acting as if they were people and humans, and some individuals are going to misunderstand what this means and interpret everything as these are persons and these are beings that have feelings and whatnot. But it comes very much from modeling the type of interaction with technology on a structure that we have for human-to-human interaction.
But do you think is that a positive thing? Because I see this a little bit as we've designed it this way. Sure, I mean, language models work this way, right? Because language builds up. But this, the idea that you should use a language model as a chat interface, or build a chat interface on top of a language model, that's something that a designer has made a decision, you know, consciously or unconsciously. So it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, in interaction design, we say that you need to have undo. And you could say that undo is that kind of, you know, repair, but it's just not in that sort of interactional way.
I would say it's a different type of repair. It's like we're backing again. A repair in conversation can never do that kind of delete what was done. You can always move forward. You can only move forward. So they are as interactive patterns, I would say they are different, but also with these type of conversational repairs that we can do different types of them. It can be that I correct myself, or I correct what you said or something, and this means different things. But you can also be specific. So you can say that, oh, exactly that word wasn't what I meant. And you can correct something in detail. So you get more precision through this type of interaction than an undo. The undo undoes the whole action. But these types of conversational repairs can be, they can target what was wrong and then keep the rest in place. So I think it's a much more powerful type of interactive system to have. So for that, I think it's good if we can do this with computers now. Like, you can start out broadly and then narrow down into what you want to do, and you just move forward and with precision. It's the only problem is that if you're misled in who is the other party and what sort of capabilities and so on that they have.
This links to some work that you've done on like on anthropomorphizing AI and so on, where the fact that you're not interacting with a person can have huge consequences or huge impact on the person. So the person doing the interaction. And I'm thinking, with the recent developments in AI, they've made these things possible more so than 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. Do we need to rethink how we deal with AI systems and how we design them and how we assign accountability and so on?
Sure. I mean, there is a risk, or there is a tendency in setting up some of these systems that you want to, you know that your system isn't capable of doing every complicated task, but perhaps it can do some easy, like initial triaging, for instance, of what kind of question is this? If you have a customer relations bot or something, what are they asking for? Who should be the right person to take over? So I think in that situation, you might want to design something that like greets a customer, ask for what they want, and then you smoothly hand over to an expert, a human expert who will take care of that. So from a business perspective, maybe that sounds like a reasonable idea, that we're not going to spend precious time on this initial part, but then we know that we need a person in the end. Looking at that from the other side, you are not invited to understand, if you're calling in as a customer, to understand who are you interacting with? What am I interacting with? And I would say there are different moral obligations that you have in relation to a human compared to what you have in relation to technical system. And I think that's something that we might want to maintain, that we have some kind of decency, try to be friendly and not yell at other people and so on. I mean, if we can maintain that towards the technologies, that's okay. But should I have to be polite to all the objects around me? I don't know. I feel I can save that for the people that I meet. And if you build these kinds of systems that always blur the boundaries and you don't know who are you interacting with, are you interacting with a human, or can you just assume that it's always going to be a bot? It sounds like a human, but it's a bot. Then you might start to develop this attitude of, okay, I don't care. I'm going to be just blunt and let them wait, for instance, if I have something else going on. So I think it's a problematic design approach from that perspective, because it fosters a kind of attitude that will spill over to other humans in the end.
But it could be the other way around, right? Because, I mean, we've been interacting with humans throughout history, right? So we're sort of primed to be able to communicate with humans. We might not be super primed to be able to communicate with devices, gadgets, and AI. And now that AI can sort of emulate a human type of feedback, it sounds as if it should be easier to just have a decent human interaction with a bot than trying to change the way we communicate because it's not a human. So, I mean, we know how to communicate with humans. We don't really know how to communicate with AI, with gadgets. If we can just communicate like humans,
wouldn't it be easier? Know. I mean, I have no problem interacting with my refrigerator or my stove. Or I mean, I like the buttons that is on the stove, and that's what I need. I don't want to, like, initiate a conversation so that we can now cook together. It's like, I just want to push a button. That's easy enough. So I think there are patterns of interaction design that has been, like, well developed for that kind of interaction. So now we have the ability to build a household gadget that also talks with you. So the question is, should it?
Yeah, but this kind of depends on what the gadget is. A stove or a fridge doesn't really need to greet you and ask you about your day. But if you have,
but
you
know, going to be
sure. But if it's like some kind of personal assistant type of thing, or HR or customer service, where you can automate currently with the current level of AI, if they become bots and we just keep a decent human communication with them, is that really a problem?
No, it doesn't have to be a problem. I think there are good examples, or there are some examples of when this works. Like, there are therapy bots, for instance, where you can have a conversation, a therapeutic conversation with this kind of system. When it works, I think it's because it's clear from the outset that this is going to be a bot. There is no question of whether or not I'm talking to a real therapist or a bot here. And I think that is the design solutions we want to see. It should be crystal clear from the outset. Okay, now you are interacting with technology. Now we're going to hand you over to a real person. Whether or not you want to be polite or do that type with the bot, that's up to you. But you have the option to choose and to know what it is. For me, that would be like the type of designs I would like to see.
But doesn't that create an added cognitive effort for the person interacting with it? So if I call customer service, and if the bot is good enough, if it can solve my problems, I don't care if it's a bot or a person. For me personally, I don't feel I need to know, as long as if I start interacting with it as I would with a person and it can actually deliver on my expectations, I don't think I need to sort of change my way of interaction, whether it's a bot or not. If my expectations are that it's going to be able to answer whatever questions I have when I interact with it as a human.
But there are certain things that are, when you are working, I would say, with the system, interacting with it, but like you're working with the system and something happens on the side, you don't have to feel guilty for your input to take longer, for instance. I mean, it could go 7 minutes and the computer doesn't care if those 7 minutes are just you're doing something else. If you're interacting with another human, I would say they do care about those 7 minutes. And maybe you wouldn't spend them looking at your emails or something, like if you knew that you were actually also interacting with a person. I think this is going to happen a lot, that maybe you have to pick something up. Or, so I think the time you spend in these types of interactions is different if you know that this is a system, that it means something else compared to if I know I'm now speaking or interacting with another human being. We have different types of obligations and should feel committed in different ways depending on that kind of setup. So once you sort of take away that distinction, that is going to have an effect on these kinds of obligations and the way we behave. Maybe not in face-to-face conversations, but in mediated conversations and mediated interactions. That will shape the type of communication we see. And I think we have seen that in online chat forums and so on. Once you take away the closeness of having to say something to someone's face, then suddenly people start to say all sorts of things that they would never dare to say in other situations. So you create a rude kind of a culture that take out the worst in people. So my speculation here is that we're going to see more of that kind of thing if we masquerade bots as humans.
So is it a design problem then? So you're talking about chat forums or whatever. Is that it's removing the sort of the human aspect of it. Is that purely a design problem then, more than something that has with AI and society to do?
I mean, this particular thing that we're talking about, I think, is very much a design problem. You can design away these. You can make clear designs and have the benefits of the much more capable large language models, because they can accomplish so much more, and you can have these types of interesting interactions. So I think you should keep that part, but you have to be careful about this other sort of how you set it up. And for that, in that sense, I think it's a design issue.
So I would tend to agree to that. I think this is definitely a design issue, which I guess is also the core thing about HCAI. But let's say, you know, we don't figure out, or let's say that the technologists that steer the development don't see it as such and just continue as it is. And what we'll end up having is the fridge being something we talk to, and the toasters and everything. Then do you think that will have an impact on how we communicate between people?
Not necessarily. I mean, we will have to figure out how to talk to these household items and how to speak to the door in order that it will let us in and so on. I think that will be a practice in its own, and we will master that. I'm not sure that it necessarily has to change the way we interact, but it's more like this: when you don't know who you're interacting with, I think then this feeling of, I don't want to be fooled by the system. I don't want to assume that I'm talking to a person. So I'm just going to assume that it's the technology. And with that follows certain different expectations, different moral obligations, and so on. So you start acting in a different way. And perhaps you then do that to a real person.
Yeah, I'm less optimistic than you. I'm concerned we will not learn how to communicate with these things as other things than people. We are so quick as anthropomorphizing technology, as any technology. The media equation says that we, you know, tend to technology just as if they are people, right? Even when they are not portrayed as being things we can talk to. And now all of a sudden we get things we can talk to. Yeah, I'm worried we might not learn to interact with these things as not things, but as people. But you're more optimistic.
Yeah, I think what happens often with many systems is that you initially, you try, it's like you have the sense that it can do anything, it's very open, and then as you try it out, you start to hit the sort of, feel the boundaries of it. You get a sense of where does it work, where does it not work. So as you get more experience with whatever system it is, you get a feeling for it. And that in itself shapes how you interact and your expectations on it. So I think that we are going to, not because of the design itself, but because any design, once you have more experience of it, that reshapes your way of interacting and so on.
But I think that applies to you and me as scholars in this sort of thing, right? But does that apply to, you know, average person?
Yeah, I think it's a feature of time rather than a feature of attitude. So, and a lot of studies are being done on new technologies and so on. They are looking at these as novel things. So you often assess a new, I don't know, setup or a system or a design, and you let people use it for a couple of hours. But I would say that doesn't really tell you anything about how it would be used after 100 hours. And that's the interesting part. Once you've learned sort of what are the affordances of the system really, then you see the real use. And I think with that's more of a thing that will happen to everyone.
So what are the biggest challenges in this? And from your perspective, what would be the biggest challenges in the next 5-10 years in learning this?
I think a major challenge is the sort of constant updates of these systems, that moving from, talk about ChatGPT and so on, like model 4 to model 5, which is sometime in the future, probably not too distant future, that then sort of whatever we learned that these systems can do and their capabilities and so forth, then that isn't true anymore, because now we have something completely different and we have to start fresh in a way and sort of assessing, okay, now this looks much smarter. Now it looks sentient again. I think a major challenge is going to be that this is a very rapid development where you don't really have the time to learn the old systems before the new ones are put in place. I think that's going to be one of these problems.
We often hear that technology is moving at a faster pace than before. I guess this is part of this. The development of any other technology has been a bit slower. You know, cars took 100 years to where they are now. GPTs took 5 years. But is that also something that we need to figure out, like how we interact as a society? I'm not just talking about ChatGPT and Gemini, but how we interact us as a society with these models, what the expectations we have on them. Is that something we need to rethink? Because this is not a technology as any other technology, right? This is something that is super fast-paced and it has aspects that other types of technologies haven't had.
Yeah. I mean, pace is one thing and it's a central part, but the other aspect here is the generality, which we have never seen before. I mean, it's often compared to electricity. And I think that's a reasonable comparison, because once you develop electricity and the systems for that, you could use it for a lot of things. And that has transformed society from the ground. And I think this is that kind of thing, because if we look at the large language models and the capabilities, it's once it gets better at everything. So you can start to apply it to so many sectors of society. And this time, we have been used to modernizing or industrializing manual labor, physical labor. We have been accustomed to that type of, okay, so now we have a better robot that can do this. We have a better process for dealing with this mechanical work. So, and what is happening now is like, now we have cognitive work that is being replaced in some parts. And that's not just in one sector, but once these systems become accessible, it's like across the board. We don't have much experience as a society in dealing with this. I don't think it's impossible, but I think that's another challenge. So the pace is one thing, but also the scale and the sector of, now we are looking at cognitive tasks that can be augmented or replaced or transformed.
Okay, I think this opens up for maybe having you back. and it seems like this is not going to be the final episode of this podcast. This warrants more discussions, and also more discussions trying to figure out what actually AGI still is, which I still don't think we know. Thank you, Yuna, so much for this, at least start of a conversation with you. I think we can go on forever.
Thank you.